Hello and welcome to the program. My name is Luke Hunt and this is another episode for Beyond the Mekong. And with me today is Joe Freeman. Joe is an American journalist. He's the co-author with Ong Nang So, and I hope I pronounced that correctly, of Frontline Poets, The Literary Rebels Taking on Myanmar's Military. Joe, welcome to the program.
Drew, thanks for having me on.
I've been following Myanmar for quite some time and spent a good deal of time up in Mae Sot and around the border areas. It's a hell of a story, and congratulations on the book. It's doing very well.
Yeah, thank you. I mean, I think the best way to describe how it started, it kind of started like I think anything else with us covering a story in Myanmar in 2015, I think late 2015. And I had moved there earlier that year, and you know, everyone, I was sort of part of an influx of journalists, a lot from Cambodia, actually, people who used to work at the Phnom Penh Post or Cambodia Daily. And this was when, you know, the story of Myanmar was sort of on the ascendant. There were going to be elections. A lot of companies were there. It was a very, very kind of optimistic and positive time. But then there were all these sort of other stories that kept cropping up to remind people that they were at the sort of picture perfect narrative of where Myanmar was heading was kind of flawed. You know, the writing was sort of on the wall in a way, but I think a lot of people maybe didn't want to pay attention. Anyway, this was one of those stories that kind of stood out as a little flaw in the narrative. And what happened was there was this poet activist, his name was Mong Sung Ka, and he had uploaded a poem to Facebook, I think in late time in 2013 and 2016, around when the sort of election, the historic election campaigning was going on. And the poem basically said that, implied that he had it more or less said that he had a tattoo of the president on his private parts. It was only something like four or five lines, kind of almost like a throwaway barb, but it just caused this huge uproar. And at the time, you know, he posted it on Facebook, where a lot of Myanmar poetry kind of still kind of exists as a publishing platform. And a person who was a sort of kind of chief of staff or something around the president's office or a high-level assistant noticed it. And then he kind of got very angry and upset. And it led to this poet, Mong Sung Ka, being accused of, kind of defamation. That's the way to put it. Look, I don't think the actual charge was something like violating the telecommunications law. But anyway, so then he was actually arrested and went on trial in Yangon. And myself and Ong Nang So, my co-author, who were covering a number of stories about the democratic transition and the election, we went out to kind of observe the trial, you know, and write I think we had planned to write a one-day story about it.
Yeah, that's a good story. It's got all the elements there.
Yeah. Definitely. And we kind of just sort of got sucked into the trial. We kept going back, and this turned into kind of a long magazine piece, which we ended up, you know, publishing online, the first note of the New Yorker magazine. And we were there for around 5 months. We had a lot of material, ended up being almost like a chapter to a length in itself. And then, you know, Fung Ka, in the end, he was convicted of the crime, but he had already spent 6 months in jail. There was sort of sentenced to current serve, and he was released. And then, like, you know, many things, we kind of moved on. But I always stuck with me as a kind of example of the power of poetry in Myanmar. You know, here you had a poet who was arrested, but it was an international news story. You know, everyone covered it. And that kind of, I guess you could say, sparked my interest in Myanmar poetry, although I had read a little bit of it before. So I kept sort of keeping tabs on it from afar. And then obviously, you know, time was on, you go on to different things. And then, you know, and I left Myanmar, where I moved to Thailand and worked in different media outlets and AFP, Vice. And kind of lost touch with the story a bit. And then the Myanmar coup happened, and Sankar, the poet, he played a big role in the protest movement in the beginning. And then he sort of shocked everyone when he started in his own armed group. So I started thinking, I think someone messaged me at the time that this was happening, that you have to kind of go back to this and kind of complete, you know, document and chronicle this story. How did this person who was just a young peace activist writing a kind of satirical poem become the leader of an armed group? So that was kind of the genesis of the book idea there. We wanted to kind of answer that question. And then on top of that, you started to notice during the coup, all these other poets who were kind of emerging into the forefront of the protest movement, including one in particular named Kezaw Win, who was killed in a kind of off-pole crackdown on the protests on the March 3rd in 2021 in central Myanmar. So I just started thinking about the role of the poet in Myanmar society, but more importantly, maybe the role of the poet as a kind of revolutionary, and what role they were playing in the uprising against the military. And that's kind of when it clicked, and I really wanted to write about this in a longer format.
Mm-hmm. Is it the poets also have a place in society where other artists don't go? And the reason why I ask this is I have met quite a few rap artists, hip-hop stars who are fighting with and performing, I guess, for the various ethnic armed organizations and the People's Defense Force. They have a tremendous following on YouTube. I know of one. I'll leave their names out because we've had issues with that before, particularly with the military. But they do have an extraordinary following, but I don't think they have the same gravitas as the poets do. Is that unfair?
I don't think it's unfair. I think it's definitely fair to say that there are definitely many kinds of different artists who are playing, who have kind of large followings and who played kind of different roles in inspiring people to, you know, stand up against oppression or authoritarianism. I think the difference with poets is sort of, you hit on it a little bit with the word gravitas. There's just more of a tradition behind it. So this, like, the tradition goes back hundreds and hundreds of years. Like, Myanmar's poetic tradition is very, very rich. It's not very known outside of Myanmar because of, well, I think a few obvious reasons. Myanmar was cut off from the world for so long, but also there's not many competent translators of Myanmar poetry into English. It's really only a handful of very well-known ones. But the story, I guess you could say, it's almost 100 years old when it comes to, trace it back almost to like the anti-colonial, anti-British era, when you had poets who are very well-known in Myanmar today, but not outside Myanmar, you know, writing poems to inspire people to rise up against the British, or even to take part in boycotts or strikes or protests, things like that. So I think what separates it maybe from other art forms is that it got this connection to this history of dissent that goes back, you know, more than a century. And I think, and that's what makes it also so interesting, because it was kind of continuing this tradition. It's not something that new. I mean, you could argue that maybe joining the armed groups is something that's a little newer, but I would still say that poetry in Myanmar has always had this kind of anti-authoritarian form of expression, you know, going back to the anti-colonial times.
Right. Now, you came up from Cambodia, as many did, and I do remember those days. In Cambodia, obviously, had other issues to deal with, particularly the 30-year civil war, the genocide, which obliterated the society as it was. Going from Cambodia to Myanmar, I was always struck, and this is going initially back 20, 25 years, that the sophistication of the people in Myanmar, the education levels, I'm always amazed at how many people were self-taught, spoke English and came from the villages, but yet they had not just a high level of intellect, but they were well-read. Like, I guess what I'm asking is, does that help in terms of the poetry?
Yeah, definitely. I think it's something I also noticed when just living in Myanmar. I mean, sometimes it felt like a more living in Manhattan or somewhere where there were a number of bookstores everywhere and people were reading and you had newspaper. I mean, the Manhattan of maybe 50 years ago or something, but you know, people were reading newspapers and it just felt like a very bookish kind of place. And again, I think that just kind of goes back to these traditions that are still firmly entrenched. So even though you had a dictatorship, you know, and the Myanmar was closed off for decades, you know, you still have this very strong tradition of newspapers, of printing, of publishing houses, of authors, of literary awards. And that still, you know, really mattered and never really went away, even if it was a co-opted time and again by various military regimes or writers were targeted. But it really has this hundred years really behind it to stand it up. So I think it's just kind of, it's got this rich legacy. And I think that part explains why this is happening today with the poet.
Right. And as a co-author, I would assume you don't want to play favorites, but anyway, that aside, who are your favorites, or who do you think are the standouts in frontline poets?
The poets that we write about, or like older poets?
Yeah,
I think maybe, God, it's hard to say. The way that we kind of broke down the book or structured it was when you look at the cover of the book, there's someone in a uniform with a book, and there's even a gun in the background. And so you think the idea of frontline poet is very much someone fighting on the front line. That's actually not the only kind of poet we feature or that we define as a frontline poet. So there are also people who are frontline protesters, you know, but they're poets. Or there are people who are living on the front line of Myanmar's refugee crisis, you know, Thailand, or experiencing, on the front line of Myanmar's mental health crisis because they've been traumatized by things they've been through. I think one of the more surprising poets in the book, at least someone I hadn't heard about until we started researching this book, is a young woman named Yo Ok Min, and she's from Moniwa in central Myanmar, and she really joined the revolution kind of almost right out of college, and she quickly became convinced that armed struggle was the answer to Myanmar's problems, these long problems of, you know, constant coups and another coup, and then, you know, this kind of vicious cycle. And she joined this armed group started by Maung Son Kha, the poet that we'd written about in 2016, BPLA. And story, I don't necessarily have favorite, but her story really stood out to me because she was very... And if you read the books, you can see this too, that we feature everyone's poems. Her poems are somewhat different than everyone else's because, first of all, they're a lot longer. And so they have more of them. They feel a little bit more, I don't know, modern or something. It's more of like a stream of consciousness style to them. And they're very, very, very personal. So, you know, you have someone who's part of an armed group, but she's writing these very personal poems about what she's going through, what she's experiencing, what it's like to kind of live in the jungle in this environment, how she feels about, you know, missing home, all these very, I think, human and recognizable emotions. And it may not be what people who come to the book, who open it, may expect to confront, because they might be thinking these are poems about, you know, very serious war subjects and saber rattling. It's not like that at all. They're very emotional, intimate, and up and close. And I think that when we've given talks and read a lot of different poems, her poetry and her experiences tend to grab people for whatever reason. I'm not sure why, but they tend to stand out.
It's interesting. I think we've all been to poetry recitals, and sometimes it's a bit like, God, get me out of here. And then at other times you've got someone up there who just kind of grabs the moment and carries the crowd along. I think what I'm trying to say is that some poetry can be dreadfully ordinary and other poetry can be, gee whiz, where did that come from kind of thing.
Yeah, totally. And I think in some ways that's why writing a book about poetry can be a bit risky, because I think many people have that fear. They have that fear of maybe being in a, having to read a poem that's a little too sentimental or kind of tacky or overly emotional, cliche. And I don't think the poems in this book are like that at all. I think they're more like what you were describing, where they make you sit up in your seat and kind of like, shake you awake a little bit. And so I would say among all the poets, that's maybe a consistent thread. There's something just very bracing about their poetry.
What you were saying before kind of grabbed my attention is that how these poets are involved with other aspects of the conflict, with other aspects of life in Myanmar. And by that, I mean, other conflicts that I've covered before, it's like one person, one job. You stand guard here, or you go to the front line, but people have very specific tasks. And one aspect I've noticed about the conflict in Myanmar is I don't really want to say multitasking or multi-skilling, but I've known rebels who deliver aid, collect school books, carry guns, work as nurses, but they do all of that. They act as fixers. It's kind of like I've always been amazed by the people who are fighting what they call a revolution, and it's difficult to find another word for that. But they had their fingers in every pie. They're involved with everything, which I find refreshing.
Totally, yeah. In fact, in some of the talks we've given, actually, if you remember, a few months ago there was a really devastating earthquake in Myanmar,
March 28th.
and I think the death toll is around over 4,000 people now. When we were I was scrolling through Facebook one day not long after the earthquake, and I just stopped on this picture, and it was people in central Myanmar delivering aid, humanitarian aid to a community that had been affected. And then I realized that the page was actually a kind of a poetry collective page, and the people delivering the aid were poets. And it kind of with the book had been out, we're doing talks about it, but here was the whole kind of thesis in action in real time, frontline poets, they were delivering frontline humanitarian aid. And I think it also, like you said, speaks to a sort of quality of Myanmar society that's very inspiring. People stand up for each other and people help each other, because I don't know why. I don't want to speculate or be too sweeping, but I just part of it is they're so used to not getting any outside help. They're so used to be cut off from the world. They're so used to night. We could see it in the response to this coup. The international community's response has been
great.
Myanmar people are so used to having to rely on themselves that they have to do things themselves. So poets don't just sit back and write poems. They also have to go and deliver aid after earthquake.
Right. I would expect that the military would not be too fond of your book. Have you had any feedback from the National Unity Government?
No, not really.
I find them a bit odd, that's all. I find them a bit, that's having worked with, I'm involved with delivering books to schools for under eights that eventually find their way over the border. And the way I understand it is the NUG, which has a very odd relationship with the EAOs and the PDF, it's quite standoffish, but they're very reluctant to get involved with anybody outside the NUG, which is why I ask if you had much feedback, if any, from them.
Well, interestingly, not really, and not that I've tried to get feedback, but in the NUG, the Minister of Defense, Yi Meng, is actually a well, he's a poet himself. He's kind of a well-known poet in Myanmar, and I met him in 20, I want to say 2016. We'd gone out to his campaign headquarters in around Naypyidaw because he had just made sort of headlines because he had beaten a general, a former general in the election, in, you know, the historic election at that time. And then when he was into parliament, we were in Naypyidaw as well, and I filmed a video of him reading a poem on the steps of Myanmar's parliament, and it was this kind of really great moment and everything. And obviously, you know, kicked out and deposed like all the other democratically elected lawmakers. But now he's the minister of defense, which is like, you know, it's a very frontline poet's kind of incarnation. All of a sudden, here's a poet who's head of defense for this opposition government. We did want to feature him a bit more in the book, actually, because we thought he was, like I said, kind of embodying this idea of the frontline poet, but it just didn't work out. Like, we didn't get the kind of interviews and access that we wanted. So, yeah, unfortunately.
Yeah, it's not surprising, actually.
What?
You know, no, it's not surprising, given the feedback I get about the NUG. From places like Maysot, the rebels who are based there, and it's a dysfunctional relationship. And I think this really matters because there is no chance in hell that the military can win this conflict, even with the support of China and Russia. I mean, it can drag on forever. But books like yours need to come out. They need to be published, and they need to push this conflict into the eyes of people in the West and across the region and say, hey, look, you know, they need a shake. Wake up. Look what's happening over here, because this conflict has been ignored for too long in the wider world. And then even, say, around Southeast Asia, there's this gross assumption that negotiations with the military should carry on. And the soldiers on the ground and the EAOs and the PDFs, they're being, to my mind, are being totally ignored. The NUG it's done a reasonable job at maintaining diplomatic relations, but there's this disconnect between the NUG, the EAOs and the PDFs, and then with the wider world.
Yeah, definitely. Extremely, shall cliche, but it's extremely complicated. But it does sometimes, I mean, one of the reasons that I thought this book might have a little bit of crossover appeal to people who maybe, you know, if they're in a bookstore or something and they see a, you know, book about Myanmar, and they go, oh, no, you know, book about Myanmar, I'm not that interested or something, I don't know anything about Myanmar or what's happening over there. But by sort of telling the story through poets, you know, through writers, I sort of was hoping that could be like a bridge to people who might not ordinarily pick up a book about Myanmar, but might be interested in literature and poetry, and then they can learn about Myanmar through these poets. Do you know what I mean?
I do. I think it'd make a wonderful present too for anybody out there trying to decide what to buy next. Oh, it's books of poetry. It's the sorts of books that should be on everybody's shelves, in my opinion, anyway. But you're based in Bangkok. You did many years in Cambodia before moving to Myanmar. How do you see the conflict evolving next, if you like to gaze into your crystal ball?
I think the main trend that is kind of concerning is from the perspective of Bangkok, is you see a kind of creeping acceptance maybe of the military as a kind of legitimate government. And while not my place to say what government is legitimate or not, I think the consequence of that is it could paper over, you know, it could almost like enshrine a situation where abuses, rights abuses and other things are just allowed to continue under the guide of kind of a legitimate authority, you know, trying to maintain control, and that the people on the ground, the people I write about in the book, sacrificed, I mean, who've kind of sacrificed their lives, you know, sacrificed their futures and their careers to try and kind of wrench back the kind of democratic Myanmar that they experienced very briefly, will just be kind of forgot and papered over. And, you know, there are these elections coming up, supposedly in December, January. You see more engagement with the military and other Southeast Asian countries. So I think, and as you said, Russia and China just kind of continue to bump the sport. So what I worry about is a kind of years-long, almost Syria-like situation where you have no real resolution, but the violence and the crackdowns and the killing continue.
Right, and the situation in terms of reportage and getting the story out of Myanmar, and also a lot of the good work that was being done by NGOs up around the Thai border areas has been significantly curtailed by Donald Trump's decision to cut USAID. I think about 400 or 500 journalists up there, at least half are losing their jobs, and the NGOs that have gone with it, it's not, it's a difficult situation.
Well, yeah, I mean, you just saw this week that the head of the Junta Minutalang, you know, thank Donald Trump, kind of getting rid of defunding VOA and FA. And it's a shame because, you know, people are learning from all the programs that are being defunded and all the people who are out of work. You know, they're far from perfect and are doing, you know.
No, they did a very good job up there. No country used to.
They've been a friend of Myanmar. They put their money where their mouth is several years on Myanmar, and now they're just kind of abandoning Myanmar. There's really no other way to put it. You know, abandoning them and helping the people who are, you know, who are leading the crackdown. So, yeah, that's a sort of wild card that maybe people didn't see coming, but maybe we should have seen coming. So, yeah, I mean, I don't know what the answer to that is, but again, I go back to what I said before, that I think Myanmar people are used to kind of not getting the help that one might expect. And so I have confidence that they'll just try to adapt in whatever way they can.
Yeah, they know how to fend for themselves. I might quickly add that the strangest twist I read in the papers so last week was Minong Lang, the junta chief, as you mentioned. He thanked Donald Trump for imposing, I think it's 46% tariffs on Myanmar, which the highest in the region. But Minong Lang was saying that the letter confirming the tariffs from Donald Trump was recognition of his regime. Really? It makes you wonder, these chaps.
But that is an interesting example of how important recognition and legitimacy is. It almost, in a way, shows how weakened they are, you know, over the past 5 years, and how they're barely kind of struggling to hold on to both just like physical territorial control, but political, geopolitical control. You know, they're desperate for that kind of validity.
Right. And before we leave, Joe, can you read us one poem from Frontline Poets, please?
Yeah, sure. Let me read one from toward the end of the book. This is by a poet named Amon, and he had fled Myanmar. He was protesting after the coup. It became a bit too dangerous. He fled to southeastern Myanmar along the border, like when he keeps it at the time. And he fled with two friends. And one of his friends, named Asai K, when they were fleeing, there was a crackdown by the military, and there was, you know, airstrikes and other kinds of attacks. And he lost touch with his friend. And they found out, you know, a day or so later that his friend had actually been killed in that attack. And he came back to bury him and kind of in the forest, more or less, inside Myanmar. And when we went through his belongings, he found a few things, including a jade earring. And I just mentioned that because he mentions this in the poem. So the poem is about his friend and what he's left behind. And the poem is called "What Have You Left" by Amo. What have you left? You left a dusty jade earring on the birthday of the god. It is a new year now. If I dig your body up, intestines askew would shout, "Federal democracy." The dropping jaws would break the downer range. What had you left? Regardless of how cold the wild snows are, It won't be as warm as your purple checkered shirt. Who would know that? How you brighten up as a son of God under the wild rubber leaves. Who would know that? How I tied my hairband in a wild cemetery. Who would know how I became uncomfortable? What have you left? Soya shouts, "This is a poet. You don't need to reveal the order." Everyone salutes. What have you left? The little forest shies. We had to leave you in the sunlight that crosses into the Thaunjin River. Let's say it's fate. Our state is like ruffled hair and an unshaven beard. What had you left? You left a poem marked deep with a knife in the teak tree by your feet.
Joe Freeman, thank you very much.
Thank you.